The striking resemblance between these early experiences by the first-generation theosophists and the contact claims of George Van Tassel, Howard Menger, Orfeo Angelassi, Paul M. Vest and many others should, in my view, be further investigated. Very little research has been done in this direction. Paranormal phenomena and the paradigm problem. Witnesses to UFO and paranormal phenomena and investigators of these observations share a common problem. From different perspectives and experiences, both groups sooner or later come to realize that the mainstream materialist, reductionist worldview or paradigm becomes untenable when faced with a large quantity of well-documented, unexplained empirical data. A natural reaction to this eureka moment is interpreting the phenomena in the light of the religious or metaphysical cultural frame of reference inherited from birth. The other alternative is entering an arduous existential journey in the jungle of conflicting philosophies and teachings, trying to find a worldview making sense of the unknown phenomena. Let me present this problem from the viewpoint of two very different individuals, UFO witness Peggy Robertock, journalist, and UFO investigator John Keel. In September 1973, Peggy Robert had a close encounter with an oscillating, saucer-shaped craft. She noticed entities moving back and forth behind windows. This UFO observation became a turning point in the life of Peggy Robert. Before this happened, she described herself as a typical ego-tripping materialist, basically interested in expensive clothes, jewelry, cars, and the good life. Now I knew there was something else in other dimensions, life that is different and more evolved. After this contact with the UFO, I couldn't accept Christianity as presented in the churches. Now I started an intensive period of searching. Peggy contacted many alternative religious and spiritual groups. She went to India to meet the Indian guru Sai Baba and for a time found inner peace with his teachings. Back in Sweden, she studied alternative medicine, reflexology, acupressure, and nutrition. After a lifetime of travel, field investigation and study of UFO, Fortean and paranormal phenomena, John Keel reached the conclusion shared by many researchers into these areas: we live in a multiverse inhabited by a variety of diverse intelligences. This discovery changed his outlook on life and his continuing search. In the classic Operation Trojan Horse, 1970, he wrote, "Previous to all this, I was a typical hard-boiled skeptic. I sneered at the occult. I had once published a book, Jadu, which denigrated the mystical legends of the Orient, but my experiences over the past few years have changed both me and my outlook, just as similar experiences have changed so many others. I have stood on many a winding hilltop staring in amazement at the multicolored objects cavorting about the night skies. I have dealt with thousands of honest, sincere witnesses by mail, phone, and in person. My skepticism has melted away, and I have turned from science to philosophy in my search for the elusive truth." Neither Peggy Robert nor John Keel evidently found the elusive truth, a tenable philosophy, worldview, or paradigm that could replace materialist reductionism. But John Keel sensed the direction research was going. In his last book, The Eighth Tower, 1975, he wrote, "Today many scientific disciplines are moving in the same direction, not realizing they are mapping a very old country. In a few years, perhaps even in our own lifetime, all sciences will suddenly converge at a single point, and the mysteries of the superspectrum will unravel in our hands." Many UFO witnesses and investigators have crossed the borderline into the multiverse by accepting some alternative philosophy, teaching, or guru as their new worldview. And here comes the tricky. They are mostly exclusive and present very different facts regarding reality. Here is a short list of options: Anthroposophy, Gurdjieff, Urantia, Sai Baba, Baha'i, Edgar Cayce, Swedenborg, Maura Storiel, Richard Kenninger, Sturgeonson, Amok, Nicholas Rerich, I Am Movement, Martinus, Theosophy, Scientology, Spiritualism, Aerius Society, René Guénon, Alice Bailey, Meher Baba, USP, Subud, Ikankar, Bo Yin Ra, Lobsang Rampa, Rosicrucian Fellowship, Sri Chinmoy, Benjamin Graham. The list could go on and on with hundreds of groups and teachers. I have the deepest sympathy for research colleagues and friends who refrain from theories, and when encountering some of the more devoted adherents of these worldviews, who have found the so-called truth, simply refuse to even consider their opinions or take some time to study the teachings. After many years of studying various spiritual teachings and worldviews, my reaction in 1986-87 was rather similar. I was simply fed up with all the irrational and inhuman ideas encountered in different groups and organizations. Disappointed with what I experienced in the spiritual underground, I abandoned my spiritual quest in 1986 and for a couple of years became active within the Swedish humanist movement, Humanisterna. During these years, I was a harsh critic of various New Age ideologies. It was a consistent and necessary psychological reaction in my life, even though, in culture radical zeal, as secular humanist, I threw out the baby with the bathwater. I never climbed so far out on a limb though as K. Gösteren, the Swedish UFO research pioneer. His assessment of the theories of John Keel and Jacques Vallée was a terrible blind alley. If there is a multiverse inhabited by various sentient beings of different evolution and intelligence, there must also be a science of the multiverse. Which implies that it is reasonable to assume the existence of scientists of the multiverse or custodians of knowledge not discovered by mainstream science. This is the position maintained by the esoteric tradition or the ancient wisdom. Readers of my blog, books and articles are aware of that I regard myself as an esotericist in the Blavatsky, Bailey, Lawrence tradition and advocate the esoteric tradition as a valid alternative working hypothesis in researching UFO and paranormal phenomena. With what I have presented above, is this a reasonable and intellectually tenable position? For me to accept, as a hypothesis, a multiverse worldview or philosophy, the following demands must be met: the basic scientific, ontological and epistemological issues and problems must be addressed in a rational and intellectual manner, not by obscure mysticism. The worldview is presented as facts and science of the multiverse. The language and terminology must appeal to scholars and researchers. New empirical data indicating a multiverse can be interpreted and understood within the worldview. The ethical message is a combination of humanism, goodwill and idealism. These demands I have found reasonably met in the esoteric tradition as represented by Helena Blavatsky, Alice Bailey and Henry T. Lawrence. There are of course statements in these teachings which I find problematic, but the basic philosophy is in my view of an intellectual quality unsurpassed. In the recently released documentary Ghost Rockets, my UFO Sweden colleague and friend Klaus Svahn addressed the paradigm problem with this excellent quote: "To believe is one thing, to know is something entirely different." The most important thing to realize for any researcher with intellectual integrity, proposing a new theory, paradigm or working hypothesis, is, it may be wrong. This of course also goes for the multiverse worldview of esotericism. But after 45 plus years of research and study, I have found no worldview that can challenge the esoteric tradition. History will prove or disprove if this really is the ancient wisdom. Esotericism for dummies. During my student years at Stockholm University in the 1970s, I did a rather extensive study of the Kabbalah, resulting in a short thesis on the early Maccabi mysticism, presented at the History of Religion department. As an addition to my academic studies, I also read every book I could find on the Kabbalah, written by various exponents of the Western mystery tradition, authors such as Dion Fortune, Gareth Knight, W. E. Butler, A. T. Waite-O. On July 29, 1975, I recorded a fascinating dream in my diary. I found myself in an antiquarian bookshop in Stockholm. Perusing the esoterica shelves, I noted a small volume with the title For One Penny Kabbalah. A sort of easy-to-understand primer, or in today's language, Kabbalah for Dummies. I bought the book, of course. This dream reminds me of the difficulty in suggesting books on esotericism for those who are not familiar with the subject. As I often refer to the esoteric tradition and esotericism on my blog, readers now and then ask for guidance in finding literature for beginners. Unfortunately, I must confess that I have not found any book I can, without reservations, recommend as a beginner's guide to esotericism. Much useful information can be found in the early Theosophical, Edia, literature, although somewhat outmoded and not always accurate in detail, as it was the first public attempt to explain esotericism. The many books written by Alice Bailey, amanuensis for the Tibetan adept D.K., are a treasure trove of esoteric information, but most of them are too difficult for the beginner as they are written for the advanced student. The best introduction to esotericism so far published on this planet are the books by the Swedish esotericist Henry T. Lorenzi, The Philosopher's Stone and Knowledge of Reality. They appeal primarily to scholars, intellectuals and philosophers. But there is still no introduction to esotericism especially aimed at the strictly empirical scientist who demand well-documented empirical data supporting the esoteric worldview. There are indications that this will be the next project implemented by the Planetary Guardians. If you are satisfied with the prevalent materialist, reductionist worldview or adhere to some orthodox theology, of whatever religion, stop reading here as esotericism will for you only be interpreted as irrational fantasies or dangerous hereticism. Better then to return to the safe world of mainstream science and the secure embrace of your church. But for the critical but open-minded seeker, this very short Esotericism for Dummies, with some relevant quotes and literary references, may be of help in discovering the Philosopher's Stone. Because of personal experiences, years of study and investigation of UFO and paranormal phenomena, or simply by gazing at the night sky pondering and contemplating the greatest enigma of them all, the existence of consciousness in the universe, you have been convinced that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. As a corollary to this heureka moment, you have also come to understand that we live in a multiverse of sentient beings and energies that humanity on this planet are not normally aware of. If there is a multiverse inhabited by various sentient beings of different evolution and intelligence, there must also be a science of the multiverse. Which implies that it is reasonable to assume the existence of scientists of the multiverse or custodians of knowledge so far not discovered by mainstream science. Now you have arrived at the fundamentals of the esoteric tradition or the ancient wisdom. Standing before the portal, you may open the door to a new world. But tread lightly, with care and common sense, because this is dangerous territory where it is very easy to get lost. A stumbling block is how to discover and define esotericism. Can any teachings be regarded as esotericism simply because the proponents of some author or mystery school use this term? Is the writings of Rudolf Steiner, Martinus, René Guénon, Krishnamurti, Elizabeth Clare Prophet, Helen Herrera K.O. to be regarded as esotericism? How do you know that what I define as esotericism is real knowledge of the multiverse? The simple answer is, you don't, as you can't verify the information given. You can only rely on your own knowledge, experience and common sense in answering this question. For the open-minded scholar studying esotericism, the advice by Henry T. Lorenzi should be remembered to keep a psychological balance and intellectual integrity, even if by thorough study you are however much convinced that the hylozoic system agrees with reality, yet you must view it as a working hypothesis. This principled attitude is necessary to avoid all manifestations of dogmatism, fanaticism, and intolerance. Henry T. Lorenzi, Knowledge of Life 4, 1995, Online Ed. p. 29-30. This is also the position recommended by the Tibetan, D.K., in the books written by Alice Bailey. Our attitude should be that of reasonably inquiry and our interest that of the investigating philosopher, willing to accept a hypothesis on the basis of its possibility. Those open-minded investigators who are willing to accept its fundamentals as a working hypothesis until these are demonstrated to be erroneous, they will be frankly agnostic. Alice Bailey, A Treatise on White Magic, original 1934. Esotericism is the science of the multiverse, the knowledge of reality offered mankind by individuals belonging to the next or fifth kingdom in nature, our future in evolution. It is not some vague form of mysticism, but as exact as any academic discipline. It is necessary to assert with vigor that esoterics is a summary of the facts which mankind has received from the planetary hierarchy and which are beyond the range of what is possible for human beings to ascertain. Esotericism is not in any way of a mystical and vague nature. It is a science - essentially the science of the soul of all things, and has its own terminology, experiments, deductions and laws. Alice Bailey. Terminology is still a great problem in esotericism, as anyone can ascertain reading theosophical classics as well as Alice Bailey. Much confusion exists as terms are used which are not clearly defined and with different meaning in various esoteric books. Bailey's teacher D.K. often commented on this issue: a new and deeper esoteric terminology is badly needed. Alice Bailey, Telepathy, 131. The Swedish esotericist Henry T. Lawrence has made a commendable effort introducing a new and better terminology in his works. But he, as well as Bailey, still use the word planetary hierarchy as the name for the organization of adepts on Earth guiding our evolution. Personally, I prefer the term planetary guardians, or the more iconoclastic higher intelligence agency, here. Neither does the term master appeal to me, as it immediately is associated with religion. Adept or teacher is preferable, as most adepts are living in physical bodies on Earth and appear very normal in all respects. They will stand forth as living examples of goodwill, of true love, of intelligent applied wisdom, of high good nature and humor, and of normalcy. They may indeed be so normal that recognition of what they are may escape notice. I would here remind you that many of the masters are married and have raised families. Bailey, The Externalization of the Hierarchy, p. 699. Esotericism is not to be confused with the mysticism of Swedenborg, Rudolf Steiner, Martinus, etc., who built their worldviews on the very unreliable astral clairvoyance instead of information from the planetary guardians. This common mistake among mystics was explained already in that pioneering book, The Mahatma Letters to A.P. Sinnett, and you have heard of and read about a good many seers, in the past and present centuries, such as Swedenborg, Bohm, and others. Not one among the number but thoroughly honest, sincere, and as intelligent, as well educated, aye, even learned. Tell me, my friend, do you know of two that agree? And why, since truth is one, and that putting entirely the question of discrepancies in details aside, we do not find them agreeing even upon the most vital problems. Letter 48. Unless regularly initiated and trained, concerning the spiritual insight of things and the supposed revelations made unto man in all ages, from Socrates down to Swedenborg and Fern, no self, tutored seer or clairaudient ever saw or heard quite correctly. Letter 40. The intellectual and cultural elite will probably not pay much attention to esotericism until we have a breakthrough in our knowledge of the multiverse. A revolutionary discovery is awaiting mankind that will force many advanced scientists and scholars to consider esotericism as a reasonable theory, paradigm or working hypothesis. This paradigm shift will be ushered in by science. Perhaps this was one reason that the adept K.H. already in 1882 exclaimed, "Modern science is our best ally." The Mahatma Letters to A.P. Sinnett, Letter 11, p. 63. A very fascinating and promising prophecy in esoteric literature is that within 100 years we will be able to photograph and film phenomena of the etheric world and other parts of the multiverse. If this prophecy is correct, that would be the definite end of materialism as a mainstream academic worldview. Our modern philosophers and scientists are not in a position to understand the importance of hylozoics as a working hypothesis. It is not intended for them. When research has advanced so far, however, that the existence of a particular physical etheric world has been recognized and the existence of an etheric envelope attached to the organism has been discovered, so many other discoveries and so many confirmations of the facts of esoterics will follow suit that many people will accept hylozoics as the best working hypothesis. We may expect a revolutionary discovery to be made around the year 2025. Henry T. Lawrence, Knowledge of Life 2, 9.4-4 online ed., In the coming centuries, man's normal habitat will be the entire physical plane up to, though not including, the second subplane. The fourth and third etheric levels will be as familiar to him as the usual physical landscape to which he is now accustomed. Men in their etheric bodies will be noted, and communicated with, and the devas and elementals of the ethers will be studied and recognized. Alice Bailey, A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, p. 474. These discoveries will slowly change our entire culture. We will finally have scientific evidence that there is no death, only a change of form. A sort of re-enchantment of the world advocated by scientists and scholars, instead of disenchantment, to use the terminology of sociologist Max Weber. It will also be realized that the esoteric tradition or science of the multiverse is and have always been there, more or less hidden, third intellectual force or pillar in cultural history alongside religion and science. Richard Kenninger, UFOs and the Esoteric Tradition. In the October 1970 issue of his newsletter Anomaly, John Keel mentioned the contactee experiences of Richard Kenninger, founder of the Stell Group and Community Stell, not far from Chicago, Illinois. In Keel's view, this was another example of the manipulative elementals playing games with a credulous victim. I bought the book The Ultimate Frontier, written by Richard Kenninger under the pen name Akalkshana, and was immediately fascinated by his claims of being contacted by a secret brotherhood. Especially as this brotherhood was said to use anti-gravity aircraft, flying saucers, as of their activities. In 1979 I entered several years of correspondence with various representatives of Stell, Nancy Loeb, Gay Lamarck, Heather Norris AO and also Mr. Kenninger himself. I subscribed to Stell Letter, later the Stell Group Letter, and acquired as much data and material I could from the group. There was one essay, Space Vehicles, Travelers, written by Mr. Kenninger, which I found profoundly intriguing. Written originally in 1966 and republished in the booklet Observations, 1971, it stated regarding flying saucers. Some are interplanetary vehicles, others are of earthly origin. The ones which are from this planet are saucer, shaped of generally trapezoidal cross, section with three hemispherical engine pods on the underside. They were first developed by man on this planet about 20,000 years ago and have been used by members of the lesser brotherhoods continuously since that time. This of course is a perfect description of the classic George Adamski, Howard Minka scout craft. In a letter to Stell I asked how the brotherhoods could keep these craft secret. The secretary, Nancy Loeb, answered, he, Richard Kenninger, smiled at your first question regarding the brotherhood's retreats for their flying saucers, and said that there are isolated places in the world which are safe from detection, and the brothers know where those places are. Letter, November 12, 1979. As to George Adamski, I received the following answer: Richard read your letter and article and wanted me, Gay Lamarck, to tell you that although he has heard of Adamski, he is not at all familiar with his experiences etc. and therefore could not comment on them. Letter, June 4, 1979. This statement was an elaborate and somewhat novel addition to the esoteric tradition on Vimanas as presented by Blavatsky, Bailey, Lawrence E.A. Oh. These classic esotericists mention aircraft used by adepts in Atlantis but not in our age. I have only found two additional sources referring to flying saucers used by secret brotherhoods today. The most well known is a quote from American contactee Howard Menger's book From Outer Space to You, 1959. There are also spacecraft, though of inferior design, which are built by people of this planet. These people are in communication and in service with people from other planets. They are people who possess a high spiritual understanding and have reached an awareness of natural law, therefore they have been entrusted with information enabling them to construct such craft. The second source is an obscure article, UFO and the Black Lodge, published in Ray Palmer's Search magazine, April 1958 and written under the pen name Devananda. This unknown author states, flying aircraft are as old as Atlantis and Lemuria. They have always moved in our skies and have always been seen by men. Both the white and black lodges use them and have always employed them for work in the world. Some are etheric, appearing and disappearing, and some are solid metals. The adepts themselves, or their pupils, are often at the controls, but more commonly robots are used. I have for many years tried to find the real name of Devananda, without success. In 1985 I wrote to Palmer Publications in Amherst, Wisconsin, but their files and records from the 1950s are no longer available. The small ad published in Fate magazine, January 1957, indicates that Devananda lived in the Chicago area. Because of my continued interest in STEL and its activities, I received a personal letter from Richard Kenninger on March 5, 1986. It was a kind invitation to become an affiliate. It is apparent from your purchase of STEL Group Publications that you are seriously interested in your character development and spiritual growth. I would like to invite you to take in the STEL Group's affiliate program. Enclosed is information about becoming an affiliate and an application form which I invite you to complete and return to us. Whatever your decision in this matter, I appreciate your sincere interest in improving humankind by uplifting yourself, Hakan. You're helping to make the world a better place. I declined the invitation but kept on studying STEL Publications. So what are we to make of Richard Kenninger and his contact claims? They are very similar to the space people contacts of George Adamski, Howard Menger and Daniel Fry, but are instead referred to as brothers belonging to an Earth-based secret society. Kenninger occasionally run into these brothers and receive instructions. In an article, A Day in the Life of a Brother, published in the STEL Group letter, July, August 1985, Richard narrates, "There hasn't been a large sampling of brothers I've run into. They don't tell me what they do for a living, and their work for the brotherhoods may be quite separate from their everyday work to earn a living. The one brother with whom I've had most contact is John, who I met in Arizona. I've seen the car he drives, but he doesn't want me to see the license plates." Much new information and a whole new perspective on Richard Kenninger and STEL appeared in 2008 when I started corresponding with Mr. Walter Cox, one of the original residents of STEL, where he lived between 1971-1976. Walter was very close to Kenninger for many years. I found his name as he answered questions on cults on answers.com and asked him many things about STEL, which later changed into private correspondence. Unfortunately, his answers on STEL and Kenninger has today been deleted from the site. There is now a very interesting website, The STEL Experience, with interviews of old and new STEL residents. Walter Cox is interviewed in a 4-1-hour series. In one of his answers on cults, Walter Cox wrote regarding Kenninger, "To sum up, I would say that Richard Kenninger showed less respect for truth than any person I have ever met. He lied about everything, large and small. He lied when there was no reason to lie. He lied to avoid the natural repercussions of his actions. He lied to his wife, his many girlfriends, his daughter and every friend he ever had. Does that mean that I think the philosophy in The Ultimate Frontier is false? No, I think the philosophy itself is sound, and I am thankful Richard wrote the book." In the 1950s, Richard Kenninger was a student of the Lemurian Fellowship in Ramona, California. He gleaned most of the content of The Ultimate Frontier from lesson material published by this organization. He was then expelled from Lemurian Fellowship and accused of plagiarism. In 1963, Richard formed the STEL Group in Chicago, which eventually led to the founding of the STEL community in the beginning of the 1970s. Because of his behavior, Richard was asked to leave STEL in 1975 and again in mid-1980s. He had seduced both married women and young unmarried women. Eventually, he founded a second community in Adelphi, Texas, where he spent the rest of his life. He died in 2002. So Richard Kenninger was just another religious rogue, fraud and trickster, or was he? Walter Cox narrates a very intriguing experience that may give a somewhat more balanced view of Kenninger. An independent verification supporting Richard's claim of a brotherhood source. The story was told to Walter Cox by one of his old friends in Stell, a man he trusts and who is not known for spinning tales. Walter gives him the alias Victor, but he has confidently told me his real name.